From Mansfield to Katanning, Hermitage to Reading, this is Lincoln Radio Journal. On this edition, a proposed state false claims act would clobber rural hospitals and Pennsylvania's small businesses. Kurt Schroeder from the Pennsylvania Coalition for Civil Justice Reform is here to explain why. Gaming revenue has once again set a new record as red-hot online gambling surges. Frank Gamrat and Eric Montardi have an Allegheny Institute report. And affordable housing is a major problem for a growing segment of the U.S. population. Emily Bry from Americans for Prosperity Pennsylvania offers some solutions on this week's Lincoln Radio Journal commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to Lincoln Radio Journal. We'll get to Kurt Schroeder from the Pennsylvania Coalition for Civil Justice Reform in just a couple of minutes, but first, news headlines from patownhall.com. Two special elections were held this past Tuesday to fill vacant seats in the Pennsylvania House of Representatives. Both vacant seats were held by Republicans in heavily Republican districts, so it is no surprise that the GOP's candidates handily won both special elections. In Adams County, Catherine Wallen was elected to replace former Representative Torrin Ecker, who resigned to take a seat on the Adams County Court of Common Pleas. Meanwhile, in Blair County, Andrea Vorobish was elected to replace Louis Schmidt Jr., who, like Eckert, had resigned to become a Common Pleas Court judge. With those two seats having been filled, just one vacancy remains in the State House. A special election will be held in conjunction with the May primary to replace former State Representative Seth Grove, who resigned earlier this year to helm a trade association. That district also leans heavily Republican, with George Margetis having been nominated by the GOP, competing with Democrat Ron Rueman. Democrats maintain control of the State House of Representatives, holding 102 seats to the 100 seats currently held by Republicans. The Pennsylvania State Senate, in a rare 49-1 vote, passed legislation sponsored by Senator Tracy Penicuck of Montgomery County that would, quote, require artificial intelligence chatbots that could otherwise be mistaken for real people to have disclosures that users are interacting with artificial intelligence and not a person, end quote. Further, if the chatbot is interacting with a minor, the notification must be repeated every 3 hours. The legislation is intended as a safeguard against sexually explicit content and communications. The One Big Beautiful Bill Act, passed into law last year, established a new federal tax credit scholarship program. The only catch is each state must opt into the program. A number of blue state governors have bowed to pressure from teacher unions and not opted into the program. The latest such governor is Andy Beshear of Kentucky. However, the Republican-controlled legislature overrode Beshear's veto of opt-in legislation, meaning Kentucky residents will now benefit from the scholarship program. Meanwhile, back here in Penns Woods, Governor Josh Shapiro has not yet indicated whether parents and students here will receive the program's benefits. He has a history of caving into teacher unions, placing him in a difficult spot as he seeks re-election this year. Read about all things Pennsylvania at patownhall.com. The Pennsylvania legislature is considering adopting a state false claims act. But if adopted, it would actually result in less revenue for the state and impose a crippling impact on rural hospitals and small businesses. Here to explain is Kurt Schroeder. He is executive director of the Pennsylvania Coalition for Civil Justice Reform. Kurt, welcome back to Lincoln Radio Journal. Kurt, we're going to discuss the proposed State False Claims Act. Tell us what we mean by the term false claims.
Well, a false claim, Loman, can be anything from a relatively simple mistake to outright fraud on the part of someone who does business for the Commonwealth. In other words, if you bill the Commonwealth for a payment for a service that you provide under a government program, that could be the subject of a False Claims Act if, in fact, you have either intentionally committed fraud or actually something much less than fraud, which is where we run into a lot of problems, especially in the healthcare field. There can be coding mistakes that are part of billing to the Commonwealth. These mistakes can sometimes add up to hundreds, and with the absolutely egregious penalties that are imposed by a False Claims Act, I'll tell you, a small business, a small rural hospital, small doctor's offices and clinics, they can be wiped out, put out of business financially by just one of these claims. And that's the reason why a False Claims Act is so dangerous to rural Pennsylvania and to small businesses who do business with the Commonwealth everywhere, but especially our small rural hospitals and doctor's offices.
And, of course, having those small rural hospitals and doctor's offices in rural areas is a growing problem here in Pennsylvania. Mm-hmm. So these False Claim Acts, Kurt, how do they work?
Well, I'll tell you, they are little more than lawsuit abuse masquerading as fighting waste, fraud, and abuse. It's really, Loma, just a cash grab disguised as reform. And it's being pushed by profit-driven attorneys who will now get a double recovery if the governor and others in the legislature get their way. So let's take a simple example. Most False Claims Acts lawsuits are brought to recover misspent Medicaid dollars, okay? Medicaid is by far, whether it's under the federal act or under a state act, it's Medicaid that is by far the biggest area for false claims recovery. And look, we all want to get misspent Medicaid dollars back. We all want to fight fraud. No one is against that. No one is against that at all. But it comes down to peeling the onion, if you will, and looking at the various layers of a False Claims Act, which then reveals what the problems are. So if a small hospital has made, let's say, coding mistakes, or a small doctor's office has made coding mistakes and ends up billing the Commonwealth the federal government for more than it should have, okay, then a False Claims Act can be brought by a private person on behalf of the government. So what we really have is an outsourcing of this recovery of state money, outsourcing it to private attorneys who are motivated by profit and who really don't care about fair and consistent enforcement of these laws. They're just out to make a buck, and they'll bring these claims whether they are meritorious or whether they are frivolous. So if a what's called a relator, the person bringing the lawsuit, you know, has information that mistakes were made, or even if outright fraud was committed, if they have this information, they go to an attorney. The attorney files a False Claims Act, making them the what's called the relator or the bounty hunter, as we call that person. And they bring a case on behalf of the government to recoup this misspent money. All right. So far, so good, except for the fact that most of these cases brought by relators or bounty hunters turn out to be meritless. Cases brought under the False Claims Act by the attorney generals, whether it's the United States Attorney General or Pennsylvania Attorney General, those cases are the meritorious ones, but these ones brought by these bounty hunters or relators, as they're called, that are really the problem and really end up doing great damage to small businesses and healthcare concerns in the Commonwealth. And once one of these cases is brought, the victim of the False Claims Act, the entity that is sued to try to recover what's allegedly misspent money, they're often they often have no choice but to settle. We call it creating that it creates a sue and settle culture. A small hospital, small business, or healthcare concern, doctor's office, they can't afford to take the risk to fight these cases, because what's at stake here is they can be responsible for treble damages, or in other words, triple what the actual amount is that they might owe the Commonwealth. And they would have to pay up to $28,000 penalty per claim. So if you have 100 coding errors, for example, that were committed by a company or by a hospital or a clinic, that can add up to hundreds and millions and of dollars when you multiply that times $28,000 a claim. And if they are convicted of that, they could absolutely, and in many cases are, just financially ruined and wiped out. So that's why most of these entities getting sued under a False Claims Act, they're forced to settle, because they don't want to take the risk of being financially ruined. And that is regardless of whether the case has any merit or not. So we have these, like I said, sue and settle situations set up where the attorney knows they're going to make a quick buck by suing an entity, say a healthcare clinic or rural hospital. They know they're going to make a quick buck. The party sued is going to have to settle because they don't want to risk being financially ruined. And the attorney and the bounty hunter walk away happy, and the healthcare folks are really put at a disadvantage. And once again, as we mentioned, in rural areas of the state, this is especially damaging, where many hospitals are just hanging on by a thread to even stay open these days.
Let's take a look at the revenue component to this, Kurt, because proponents of this act are saying, well, we have this state budget deficit, if in fact they admit to the fact that we do have a state budget deficit, which we clearly do. But they're saying this is a way to fill that revenue gap. So if we had a state False Claims Act, would it bring more money into the state treasury?
If only. I've heard claims that it will bring in upwards of $3 billion to close the current budget deficit that you just referred to. And so therefore, this is a quick, easy way to bring in money to the Commonwealth. And legislators like it because they believe they can bring in money without having to raise taxes. So they get more money, more revenue in a painless manner. Well, here's the truth. The experience of other states does not support these claims that are being made. New York has a state False Claims Act. They've brought in $4 billion. But guess what? That's over the last 15 years, okay? California's brought in $3 billion over the past 10 or 15 years. Minnesota has brought in $60 million over the past 15 years or so. So there is no way, based upon the real life experience of False Claims Act in other states, that Pennsylvania is ever going to see $3 billion during this current budget cycle to help close that revenue gap, as some predict.
We have been talking with Kurt Schroeder. Kurt is Executive Director of the Pennsylvania Coalition for Civil Justice Reform. Kurt, tell us a bit about the coalition. Also, if folks would like to learn more about this proposed State False Claims Act, where can they go on the web to get that information?
The Pennsylvania Coalition for Civil Justice Reform is a statewide association which is dedicated towards fighting lawsuit abuse in Pennsylvania. Our website has good information, and that is at paforciviljusticereform.org. That is paforciviljusticereform.org.
Kurt Schroeder from the Pennsylvania Coalition for Civil Justice Reform. Kurt, thank you for being with us.
Thank you, Loman.
Pennsylvania is once again raking in record revenue from gaming taxes. The surge is being fueled by skyrocketing revenue from online gambling. For details, we turn now to Frank Gamrat and Eric Montardi for this Allegheny Institute report.
Hello, and welcome to the Allegheny Institute Report on the Lincoln Institute Radio Journal. I'm Eric Montardi. Joining me today is Frank Gamrat, Executive Director of the Allegheny Institute. Frank, how are you today?
I'm doing well, Eric. How are you?
Doing just fine, Frank. Thank you very much. Your most recent policy brief deals with gaming. The Pennsylvania Gaming Control Board recently reported on 2025 gaming revenues. What did the board have to say?
Well, gaming in Pennsylvania has taken off, right? And so in the calendar year 2025, the Commonwealth has set yet another record. And it's just becoming one after the other. 17 casinos across the state, they collected $6.78 billion in total revenue for those machines. Now, of course, the state likes it because they get to generate tax money from that. And of course, each game has a different tax level. And our listeners can read about that on our website, Allegheny Institute.org. In 2025, $2.87 billion in taxes were collected off of the, there's six different options for gamblers in our state. Now, again, you're 12.4% better than the taxes generated in 2024, which came in at $2.55 billion. So to say that it's a growing industry across this Commonwealth is probably an understatement, and the government and the state government is enjoying it.
How is internet gaming performing compared with the traditional slots and table games?
The listeners out there, they recall that slots were the first one to be enacted. I think back in like 2004, 2005, the legislation was passed. And we had nothing but slot machines. At the time, it was like 11, 12 different casinos. And the peak for slot machines was in 2012. Well, then in 2010, of course, we introduced table games. And then in 2019, the floodgates opened. They introduced the internet gaming, sports wagering, fantasy sport contest, and video game terminals. And internet gaming, of course, it was introduced in 2019. The pandemic, of course, hits in 2020. And internet gaming kind of starts to really take off in 2021. 2020, the first full year of internet gaming, total revenue from the three different options for internet gaming, slots, tables, and poker, was $565.8 million. In 2021, it had doubled to $1.11 billion, and by 2025, at $2.78 billion. So from 2021 to 2025, internet gaming has grown about 150%. So it has certainly exploded with people doing the gaming on their phones or on their computers, and that seems to be where it's hot right now. Retail slot machines, those are slot machines at physical casinos, they've kind of plateaued. They've been fairly flat. Since 2023, they're down about 1%. 2024-25, they're down about 0.6%. And internet gaming, overall has taken over retail slots. Table games has been kind of flat for quite some time. Retail table games as tables at casinos. But the fastest growing and hottest form of gambling in the Commonwealth is internet gaming.
Is there a form of gaming that is having an influence on the state's efforts to tax and regulate skill games?
Oh, absolutely. We look across the landscape, and just when you think that there could not be any more ways you can gamble, along come skill games. And we'd written about skill games way back in 2025. It's an unregulated, untaxed form of gambling. A skill game was made legal by the Pennsylvania Commonwealth Court 2023, and they basically said it differs from a slot machine. And this is kind of the interesting part. It looks like a slot machine. It acts like a slot machine, but it's not a slot machine. And what differentiates a skill game from a slot machine is that when the reels stop, you have the ability to move one reel up or down to give yourself a win. So if you have bar, cherry, cherry, and there's a cherry in the upper space above the bar, you can hit the down button to bring that cherry in line. So now you've got three cherries. So it's manipulated a little wee bit. And the second thing the courts ruled is you can memorize patterns. For those of us long in the tooth and can remember Pac-Man, there's a pattern to the ghosts. And if you memorize the pattern, you can go pretty far. Now, I'm not that bright to memorize the patterns of Pac-Man, and I certainly can't memorize the patterns of skill games. But according to the Commonwealth Court, you can memorize the patterns of the skill games and know what's coming next. Beyond me, but that's what makes them different from a slot machine. And these skill games have kind of popped up in a lot of places. We have no knowledge of how many skill games are out there. The American Gaming Association estimated in 2025 that there were 67,000 skill games across the Commonwealth. But nobody knows because they're not regulated. If you call the Pennsylvania Gaming Control Board, they'll tell you they have no idea. The only way that you could find is if you went through everybody's tax return and saw if they claimed profits from the skill games that they might own. So they're showing up in grocery stores. They're showing up in mini marts. They're showing up in gas stations. They're showing up in bars, restaurants. They're a little bit everywhere. And so because they're not regulated and they're not taxed, that, of course, made the governor's list of things to do. And it was on his list last year with them not being regulated or taxed. Casinos went, well, wait a minute. If they're not being taxed, we shouldn't be taxed either. So there's a little pressure on the governor to keep the gaming industry happy, keep the casinos happy, because if they don't, that's a big chunk of the tax money that they're going to lose if the casinos stop paying taxes. He has looked around and says, well, video gaming terminals are the closest thing we have to slot machines. They're taxed at 52% of revenues. Let's use that as a model. Now, video gaming terminals, for those that aren't aware, there are qualified truck stops across the Commonwealth. By qualified, they have to sell a certain amount of diesel per month. It's like 50,000 gallons on average. They have to have 20 trucks. Commercial vehicle spaces available. They have to have islands specifically for diesel. There's qualifications that make it a truck stop. So your local gas station cannot call itself a truck stop. And it's along our interstates. There's 75 of them, and they are restricted to 5 machines per truck stop. And so they're taxed at 52% at the revenues. Now, gaming terminals, let's just say we have $6.8 billion in 2025. Video gaming terminals responsible for $41.5 million. So it's like less than a percentage of the overall gaming, and not much. But the other part of the governor's proposal is not only does he want to tax skill games at the 52% rate for video gaming terminals, he wants to limit the number of skill games to 40,000. Now, the argument is going to come up, and it has in this with some senators and whatnot. Social clubs rely on these skill games. The veterans, the fire department, the VFWs, they rely on the mom and pop restaurants that are having a hard time. The bars having a hard time. They need these games to add to their revenue stream so that they can make it in the communities. And let's face it, with 17 casinos across the Commonwealth, I'm sure there's one reasonably close to you, but you get in the upper reaches of the northern panhandle, the northern tier, Pennsylvania, and you got nothing. A long way to go to a casino. So maybe the skill game's worth it there. Look, they're going to need to be regulated and taxed at some point. If nothing else, they need to be regulated to make sure that they're fair. In our brief from last year, we talked about Wyoming. Wyoming has them tested so that they're known as being fair machines, kind of like you would measure a gas station. If it says 1 gallon has been dispensed, 1 gallon's being dispensed, plus or minus. So you need to have them make sure that they're fair. Will they be taxed? Yes, it's low-hanging fruit. The governor's gone for it. The competing measure in the Senate, but hasn't made it to the Senate. It's just in committee. It's been 16% they agreed to. I don't know. It's going to be worth looking at in the future. But gaming is here to stay. The government can't get enough of the tax revenue, and evidently the citizens of Pennsylvania can't get enough of gaming.
Frank, great stuff as always. We appreciate you sharing that with our listeners. For Frank Gehrmat, this is Eric Montardi, and this has been the Allegheny Institute Report on the Lincoln Institute Radio Journal.
Potential changes to state and local regulations will go a long way to making housing more affordable. Emily Bry from Americans for Prosperity Pennsylvania talks about it on this Lincoln Radio Journal commentary.
Pennsylvania's housing affordability crisis stems from complex zoning laws and bureaucratic barriers, not a lack of land or builders. Across the Commonwealth, housing prices have surged. The median home listing price in Pennsylvania climbed from about $184,900 in 2016 to roughly $325,000 by just last year. For families and young couples trying to buy their first home, or seniors hoping to downsize, that jump puts home ownership further out of reach. At the same time, Pennsylvania simply isn't building enough homes to keep up with demand. From 2017 to 2023, housing permits increased the state's housing supply by only 3.4%, even though the number of households grew 5.1%. When demand grows faster than supply, prices go up. It's basic economics, and unfortunately, potential buyers are paying the price. Why aren't we building enough houses? One reason is that Pennsylvania's zoning system is incredibly fragmented. The state has more than 2,600 municipalities, many of which have their own zoning codes and approval processes. As a result, developers and even small local builders have to navigate thousands of different rules just to build homes. In many communities, the rules allow only one single-family home per large lot, sometimes close to an acre per home. Even in areas with water, sewer, and infrastructure that could support more families, the law prevents it. The result? Fewer homes, higher prices, and fewer options for young families trying to put down roots in Pennsylvania. That's why policymakers are looking at common sense land use reforms to increase housing supply and restore affordability. One key proposal would update Pennsylvania's municipality's planning code to allow duplexes, triplexes, and fourplexes in areas currently zoned only for single-family homes in communities with populations over 5,000. Another plan, poised to move in the State House next week, would legalize the construction of accessory dwelling units on properties across the Commonwealth. This kind of housing, sometimes called, quote, missing middle housing, was once common in American neighborhoods. It allows multiple families to live in attractive homes that look like single-family houses, but provide more housing units on the same land. Allowing duplexes, triplexes, and fourplexes doesn't eliminate single-family homes, but instead gives property owners more freedom to build housing that meets today's needs. As a result, we get starter homes, more options for seniors who want to age in place, and more affordable housing close to jobs and schools. Most importantly, this approach doesn't rely on heavy government subsidies or new bureaucracies. Instead, it removes the barriers that government created in the first place, allowing the market to build more housing where people want to live. Other states across the country, from Montana to Florida, have already taken steps to modernize zoning and increase housing supply. Pennsylvania would be wise to follow their lead. At the end of the day, housing affordability comes down to a simple principle. When you make it easier to build homes, more homes get built and prices stabilize. Pennsylvania's potential is endless. If Pennsylvania wants to remain a place where families can afford to live, work, and raise the next generation, we must cut red tape, modernize zoning laws, and let builders get to work. Fortunately for us, there's a bipartisan movement in both chambers to make this a reality. Visit AFPPennsylvania.com to learn more and take action by sending a message directly to your member. Support common sense economic policy. Advocate for more housing to make prices more affordable for more Pennsylvania families. Again, visit AFPPennsylvania.com. This is Emily Bry, State Director with Americans for Prosperity, Pennsylvania.
If you miss hearing Lincoln Radio Journal on your favorite radio station, audio of our complete program is available on our websites, LincolnRadioJournal.com and LincolnInstitute.org. The 2026 Pennsylvania Leadership Conference is just a couple of weeks away. The Pennsylvania Leadership Conference is the premier grassroots activist event each year. This year's Pennsylvania Leadership Conference will be held April 9th through 11th at the Penn Harris Convention Center in Camp Hill. This year's featured dinner speaker will be Chris Ruddy, the founder and CEO of the Newsmax Cable Television Network. Washington Examiner columnist and Fox News contributor Joe Concha will be the conference luncheon speaker. They will be joined by a wide array of speakers, panel presentations, and an expanded menu of workshops. Complete information and registration for the 2026 Pennsylvania Leadership Conference is now available at paleadershipconference.org. Join us for the conservative event of the year, the 2026 Pennsylvania Leadership Conference. Again, registration is available at paleadershipconference.org. The Lincoln Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, including the Houston Foundation of Coatesville, the Pennsylvania Manufacturers Association, and the Allegheny Foundation of Pittsburgh, all of whom have helped to underwrite the cost of this program. Lincoln Radio Journal is a trademark of the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guest and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. From the Frederick W. Anton III Center in Harrisburg, I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to Pennsylvania's most widely broadcast public affairs radio program, Lincoln Radio Journal. Plug into the pulse of Pennsylvania.